Sorry for the slightly longer intro there. We're going to get off going with the show now. I'm Darren Kaster. You are listening to The Green Majority. I've got Kevin Farmer as well in the studio here, who's going to give me a little bit more of a hand than usual because I'm the one with the rough voice this week. So I do apologize. This is The Green Majority brought to you by Darth Vader this week. Thank you very much. We've got some fun stuff for you today. Unfortunately, because of my voice, I'm going to try and do as little as talking as possible here. So Kevin's going to jump in and give me a hand. We've got an interview at the beginning, which is with Paul Figueres. I apologize if I've butchered your last name. I'll be corrected shortly once we get him on the phone, I'm sure. But Paul is from the Vegan Environmental Party of Ontario, and this party came out, was founded in 2011. Their mandate says that they are advocates of animal rights, the environment, and social justice. So I wanted to talk to Paul and just find out some of the more details specifically about their particular platform, but also specifically just simply about being such a, I mean, name only. There's the Green Party, and then there's the Vegan Environmental Party of Ontario. As far as labeling yourself, definitely a sub-market, right? Environment doesn't appeal to everybody, so they're going after a target audience, I'd imagine. So we're going to have Paul on, ask him to explain some of the rationale there, explain some of the policy ideas that they had going forward. And then after that, as I said, to spare my voice, we're going to play a little bit of stuff from Annie Leonard, who's the co-director of the Story of Stuff project, and she's also the narrator of those. The videos themselves are exceptional. They're actually like hand-drawn stickmen diagram videos to go along with the audio that you're going to hear today. So yeah, I'm certain that you're going to thoroughly enjoy it if you haven't heard the Story of Stuff project before. But please do, if you enjoy it, go check out the website. We'll have links posted to all the videos. They will be up there as well. Definitely worth watching. We're spreading each video. They have, I think, about 8 or 10, Kevin. And each one has over like 1.5 to 2.5 million views. So they're doing pretty well. Have you seen Story of Stuff before?
No, actually, I haven't.
All right, so stay tuned. We'll introduce you to that, and then Kevin will send him home to watch the videos as well. But that's going to be coming up as well. And then we're going to be tossing around a couple of news stories. As soon as I hear that we're ready to go, that we'll be doing that. And then, of course, we also have music today from Open Till Midnight blog. Thank you very much again, as usual, to DJ Amber Waves at Open Till Midnight. You can find a link to their website, or her blog, rather, for all the music. She does all the music programming on the show, so big thanks to her. We're also just letting people know that Leah is at the computer today, so if you have any questions, comments, concerns, either for our guest, if you're listening live, you can send us a Twitter at Green Majority, and Leah will pass it along to me. You can also join our Facebook page, go to the website. The show will be posted up there afterwards as well, so if you miss any of the content today, or perhaps you just couldn't hear my crackling voice well enough, you want to hear it all over again, you can go to the website greenmajority.ca today after the show. But for now, I do have Paul on the line. Are you there, Paul?
I am here.
Now, first thing I have to ask you is whether or not I butchered your last name.
No, you did it. You did a fantastic job. Yeah.
Awesome. I get one out of every few. I've got Kevin as well here. He's going to be jumping in because unfortunately my voice is a little rough today, so we're going to be sort of sharing. But the first thing I wanted to kind of get out of the way here was, as I was sort of mentioning during the intro there, you know, the Green Party of Canada is someone else who's been identified themselves as an environmental party. They've been around for many, many years and still finding in the low percents in a lot of places, not huge representation. We have another environmental group. For your average voter that doesn't necessarily see all the micro differences between anyone except for the three majors, how do you make yourself stand out? And if you want to explain your platform and how that applies to generally to Ontario. So we'll go through some of the details later, but just what sort of face are you hoping to present to Ontarians?
Sure, absolutely. So just to kind of touch on the differences first, certainly, and this is something that I've been approached by folks with several times regarding why we are set up as a party when there's a Green Party. And kind of the key differences that we have is we feel from the get-go that we're more green in terms of our environmental policies. The Green Party does not promote the abolition of animal agriculture as we promote. Of course, animal agriculture by both the United Nations and Livestock's Long Shadow report and by World Watch Institute, having been singled out as the single greatest contributor greenhouse gas emissions as an industry on the planet, along with the greatest contributors to soil depletion, water pollution, energy usage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's really a long litany of list of environmental issues that go along with it. But the question of representation and how to put on a different face. I think actually it also stems from two key problems that we have within our electoral system. So I don't feel that representation within the voting public voters who are interested in green issues and who would vote for parties that are promoting green issues. I think the greatest problem that we run into is the lack of an electoral system that is actually fully democratic. Our first past the post system, of course, doesn't accurately represent the views of voters as a proportional representation system.
So I'm glad you started there. That's actually where I wanted to start as well. This at first read, you wouldn't immediately associate this as an environmentally relevant issue. But why is it? Why is something called about proportional representation and shading the voting system important for an environmental group?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's not just important for an environmental group. Certainly, it's important for any party that is not in the big three as we typically understand them. Simply because what a lot of people are beginning more and more to understand is that when you go to the polling station and you cast your vote, if you haven't actually cast your vote for the specific individual who gets the most votes in your riding, your vote has essentially been wasted. Something which doesn't happen in a proportional representation type of system, it benefits everyone. It actually brings more voices to the table. It encourages political parties to act more cooperatively across the floor. So there's really a litany, and of course it promotes democracy. So there's a litany of reasons why not just a small party or an environmental party would be interested in this, but why it benefits all parties and everyone in society.
Well, I guess it wouldn't be able to benefit all parties. There would certainly be some losers, but I think the majority of parties may end up getting their votes split a little bit wider.
Well, I would contend that the promoting a more democratic system definitely benefits all parties. Whether you receive more votes or less votes as a result of better democracy, certainly better democracy is a benefit.
I would have to agree. Maybe what I could rephrase that as: not all parties would see it as a benefit if their only concern is as many voters as possible.
Sure, absolutely. Yes. if we had a PR system in place, both at the provincial and the federal level, for example, we wouldn't have a majority Harper government at the federal level right now because they only took away something like 37% of the popular vote.
Okay, so let's get a little bit into some of your other platform issues here. One of the things, just at first glance, when I skimmed through, was that I saw sort of a general theme about increased funding for post-secondary education. So you wanted to eliminate post-secondary fees and that sort of things. There was what else? There's a couple other ones here that grabbed my attention. Sorry, nutritional counseling. A lot of things in general. End government funding for animal agriculture was one of the only ones that I saw that was actually a removing of funds. Has this all been like balanced, or are these sort of ideals that you hope to strive for? What way? Because the general impression that I got from skimming through the first thing, that the only conclusion would be that taxes would have to go up.
Right.
Has that balanced? Have you actually run the good numbers on that?
Yeah, absolutely. We put a lot of thought into where the dollars and cents come from. So if we take, for example, the elimination of post-secondary tuition fees, we certainly, of course, it appears as if at the outset this is simply an outlay of funds, which per student in terms of a budget is really a drop in the bucket. But when we look at it from a cradle to grave type of perspective, we begin to understand that a more educated populace is a populace that, for example, tends to engage in at a lower rate in violent crime. So policing goes down. It's also a populace that tends to take better care of their health. So healthcare costs go down. It's also a populace that if you have a better education, you tend to, over the course of your lifetime, contribute a greater amount of dollars to the tax base because you're earning more. So when we look at it from cradle to grave, it really we feel a lot of the paybacks they come back in an exponential kind of fashion, and of course we have a happier society. I mean, if we remove this stress of having to figure out a way to pay for post-secondary education, whether it be through parents having to save for many years or students, which majority of students having to take out massive loans and live in their parents' basement for multiple years trying to pay them back after college university education. I mean, this is really what we're talking about. You know, it's creating a happier, more egalitarian type of society.
All right. Right. Now, just coming back general concepts again for a minute there, even just the name grabs me for a minute. The Vegan Environmental Party of Ontario. We did a show with Leah actually as our guest a while ago about veganism, vegan food, and we talked a little bit about some of the biases that people have against even, while it's becoming more popular first in some circles, it still is a euphemism for calling you a loon to say that you're a vegan. What is your intention around getting acceptance of that? Are you looking for a hardcore, dedicated core of people to support your party to affect policy and then hopefully one day get elected? Or do you think that you can go out and change people's minds about these issues? Because I have to say that my first instinct would be that many people, not necessarily me, but many people would even just look at the name of your party and go, bunch of nutters.
Right. Absolutely. And I think this is part of the reason that we wanted to ensure from the start that we had such a well-developed platform with various issues that reach different people. But a lot of the idea behind crafting the name as we did was to draw the inference in people's minds between veganism and environmental issues, show the correlation between the two. Within a lot of people don't know this, but within the Green Party proper itself, there's been a lot of discord around this issue, and a lot of people who were promoting plant-based diets, vegan diets, have actually left the Green Party as disgruntled ex-members because there really is not a lot of place for dialogue there, and we think this is a major problem. It's a major issue. We think more people and more every day are becoming more attuned to environmental issues, more attuned to the tolling of the bell, so to speak, that we're in as a planet. Although we've talked about this for many years from an anecdotal perspective, the correlation between vegan diets and the environment, it really wasn't until the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization published their great report, Livestock's Long Shadow, that the numbers really became quantified, and that the anecdotal aspect of it was made moot. So there is really no dispute at this point. The Livestock's Long Shadow pegged the piece of the pie as 18% of global greenhouse gas emissions coming from animal agriculture. That's above any other industry in the world, including transportation. When World Watch Institute recrunched the numbers, and they recrunched the data accounting for certain data streams that were left out of the calculations, they came up with a number of 51% for animal agriculture. Whether we say it's 18, whether we say it's 51, or whether we say it's somewhere in the middle of that data, we can certainly agree that the numbers are really significant, and it's something it's an issue that's very easy to resolve for the average person, regardless of economic status, regardless of any other of gender, of any other type of difference, because it's an issue that can be resolved with your fork. And I like to say to people, it's actually something that although most things are based on an action, you have to go out and recycle, you have to go out and compost. This is in many ways based on an inaction, based on not making a choice to reach your arm out in the grocery store in that meat aisle or in that dairy aisle or in that egg aisle. So I like to call this kind of the lazy person's vegan.
I had one final question for you before we went, but I think Kevin wants to jump in here before we get to that. Kevin?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment. Hi, Paul. This is Kevin. As a vegan and an environmentalist myself who supports proportional representation, I'm very susceptible to your message. I also like your focus, particularly in healthcare, on preventative medicine and nutritional counseling as opposed to ad hoc medical treatment for diseases that have already occurred. I too question the use of the word vegan. Being a vegan myself, I know I'm often treated as Darren said, as a bit of a loon. And even with a burgeoning awareness of environmental issues, vegans are still regarded with some skepticism. But I'm wondering, how much support are you garnering with this platform and with this name? Did you run a full slate of candidates in the last Ontario election, or what's your status really as a political entity?
Sure. We ran three candidates in the October 2011 elections. With those three candidates, we pulled in just under 400 votes, which doesn't seem like a lot. But if we factor in that we were at the time of the election, we were a party that was about a month old.
Right.
We were a party who was literally operating on a shoestring, and so we did very little because we didn't have the financial wherewithal to do very, very, very much. We did very little campaigning. So I think even putting aside, of course, we recognize that there's always a percentage of voters that vote kind of as a protest vote. But even putting aside that, I think that was relatively significant. And to harken back to your comments about vegans still being semi equated with looniness type thing, this is kind of another reason that we wanted to make sure that that the word vegan was front and center in our party name, not just because it informs an animal rights philosophy, informs the basis of all of our policies, humans being animals as well, so our social justice for humans policies are informed by that as well, but also because we want to demystify the word vegan for people. We want to take away some of that misconception that there's something kind of weird about it.
Right.
I know myself personally, after I had three all candidates debates that I was able to participate in my riding, and I had multiple people come up after the all candidates debate to congratulate myself and the party on having such a comprehensive type of platform, and that there were things in our platform that they would be very willing to vote for. Incidentally, a lot of things in our platform that are not touched on with the breadth that we do by other political parties, including the Green Party.
All right. Well, I think that's a really good place to come back to my final question before I'm afraid we've run out of time. We're going to have to move on. But just in the last minute here, one of the other things that I sort of pulled from just from glancing over the entirety of your brief on the website there, which we will have a link up to afterwards as well, and give you an opportunity to say the website in any way if people want to get in contact with you as well. You can mention that as well. But one of the things I've noticed in the few years that I've been paying close attention to politics is that there's a significant number of people, like we can very easily sit on sort of the environmentalist side of the fence and say, okay, well, we have all these facts and data, and there's all this information showing how terrible consuming meat is for the planet, and it's not even really that great for your diet. It's certainly the old myth of more meat equals stronger is certainly been dissolved, but
right,
there's still sort of a social acceptance of this. Is that people's knee-jerk reaction isn't to, hey, how dare you tell me not to eat meat? And you go, oh, well, here's a bunch of data that shows you why it's bad to eat meat. And they go, oh, okay, I agree with you. It's that there's just a fundamental worldview issue with a lot of voters on the other side of the aisle, if you will, that is really not even about the facts. It's about, I do not want a government telling me what I can and can't do. Even if, as a concept, they're willing to say that they're sympathetic to environmental ideas and they don't want to hurt the planet, as soon as it comes down to, I'm going to legislate this or I'm going to legislate that, a lot of people don't like that. Have you worked out a way to sort of either introduce this or soften it or approach that type of voter at all? Or are you sort of simply hoping that that's a small enough component that you can sidestep them?
Right. It is something that I've thought about at length and I've addressed with different voters. When it comes down to what perhaps the core of our platforms and policies are as a party, I think you could boil them down to a couple of words. And two words that kind of spring to mind are harm reduction. So we are looking as much as possible, and I think this is actually something that's positive as a societal theme as well, to reduce harm for as many individuals as possible. Now, certainly for multiple reasons that you mentioned, including that it's better for your own individual health as a person not to consume animals, the moving to an ethos as a society, and certainly legislatively as a society, to a place where we are putting in place the stop cocks, for lack of a better word, that in effect result in harm reduction, I think is a positive thing. And most people generally, I think, can go along with that. Now, certainly it is an argumentative shift that we have to make with people, a winning hearts and minds type of idea, get people to understand that the species, the arbitrary species line that's drawn between, okay, you are a human, so you are protected by law, and have an inherent right to expect a certain amount of harm reduction. You are a dog, you get a different type of harm reduction protected by law, and you as a quote-unquote food animal have virtually no protection. In fact, the way the legislation is written for animals that are considered food animals is that whatever is the industry standard is what is considered acceptable. So that leaves a lot of latitude and a lot of leeway, and I think part of the issue is that most people are not aware of the latitude and leeway that does exist within current legislative model, and as a result of the latitude and leeway, the incredibly horrific things that happen to these very sentient, very very aware feeling beings who really, for all intents and purposes, they really have their primary interest in avoiding suffering and harm.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Paul Figueres from the Vegan Environmental Party of Ontario. Paul, just before you go there, do you want to give people the web address and if there's an email address or something, people can contact you if they have further questions?
Absolutely. Currently, we have our web address currently down, but we have a Facebook page, and you can find that through Vegan Environmental Party. I can always be reached by email at earthcitizen@rogers.com. That's earthcitizen@rogers.com. And I wanted to thank you very much for having me on. It's been a really great conversation.
Absolutely. Our pleasure. So we're going to go to a music break now. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes to talk to Kevin Farmer about some news stories, and then we're going to hear from the story of stuff. Stay tuned.
Might say hers, it might have out of line.
right, and we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority with a slightly less croaky, slowly improving voice of Darren Kaster, also joined by Kevin Farmer in the studio. The music, of course, was programmed by Open to Midnight. That's DJ Amber Waves. We'll have a link to all the songs. This week, they're all free to download as well. So if you like any of the music from today, go check out our website afterwards. We'll have links to all the downloads for all these songs. Absolutely fantastic stuff. Thanks so much to her. Also, thank you, Leah, very much setting up a lot of the show today and sitting on the Twitter feed there, paying attention. If anyone wants to chat with her, she's eagerly ready to go. Kevin, you and I were going to chat for a couple minutes, though, and I understand you came prepared with something you wanted to talk about.
Well, there's been a study recently released about the effects of soot on climate change, and this is new research. This is news in the sense that the role of soot has been debated in the past, and it hasn't been clear whether soot was exacerbating climate change or whether it was mitigating climate change. You know, you've got particles in the atmosphere; they're scattering light. What are they doing? Are they cooling the planet? Are they heating it up? And this study has concluded that that soot is not only exacerbating climate change, but at levels greater than were anticipated for people who were arguing that soot was indeed an exacerbation. And what's interesting about this is that, one, it opens a new front in the battle with climate change. And but there's also some room for a little bit of optimism, a little bit of uncharacteristic optimism here, in the sense that
You feeling well, Kevin?
Yeah, I'm just recovering from a cold, so I might be addled. I might just be happy to be alive. But the thing is with soot is that it is a very short lived. It's very short-lived in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide stays for decades. I forget how long methane stays in the atmosphere, but you know, other greenhouse gases. Soot isn't a gas, but other greenhouse, I don't know what to call them, accelerants,
particulates.
But other greenhouse gas aggravators stay in the atmosphere for a significant amount of time, whereas soot is very short-lived, measured on the order of days. So if you were to combat soot at the source, you would see an immediate reduction in the greenhouse gas effect, because you would be eliminating almost immediately with a turnaround time of literally days. And it's also possible to address the sources of soot, since a large component of it comes from the burning of diesel fuels. Some soot would be very hard to address, because it comes from the burning of firewood, and some cultures still burn down forests to plant agriculture. And you know, for an astonishing proportion of the world's population, wood is still the main fuel supply, especially for heating. So obviously, like everything to do with the complicated issue of climate change, it's complicated, but it does open a door to, say, mitigate climate change in the near term, which has previously been unexplored territory, because mitigation strategies have typically been conceived of in terms of decades, whereas, you know, tipping points in climate change are rushing down on us in maybe we've passed them already. We're not even sure, but we're quite certain that they're approaching very, very quickly, and our mitigation strategies at best, even the most optimistic ones, are talking about, you know, 2020, 2030, 2050 for the PC government, for the Harper regime. So, if we could address it, we might buy ourselves some time to let some of these more longer-term mitigation strategies actually bear fruit.
When we're thinking soot, the first thing I thought of was coal. Did it mention very
much?
Oh,
yeah, sorry, coal. Well? Coal. And that's where, you know, you can't ignore the elephant in the room, which is China. And China's industrializing at a blinding, breathtaking pace, and they're relying primarily on coal. And unfortunately, Chinese coal is some of the dirtiest coal in the world, which usually means it has a high sulfur content, but it also it doesn't necessarily mean it produces more soot, but they're so sorry, you know, to call it dirty coal is actually a little bit off topic. It there's other harms coming from the burning of Chinese coal, but certainly because they're so reliant on coal and they do produce a lot of soot, and they're just reeling with the effects of air pollution. I don't know if people caught it on the news recently, but the air quality in Beijing was such that the government advised people to stay indoors. Classes were canceled. People were wearing masks in the street, and the 2.5 micrometer diameter particles were being measured in almost 900 micrograms per cubic meter of air, and anything over 25 is considered dangerous.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just off the scale. It was just like, it was so off the scale. It was seismic in its proportions.
And well, I remember from the Olympics that went through a few years ago, they were doing, like, beforehand, they were trying to deal with air quality.
Oh, they were shutting factories down.
Yeah, they had to turn, like, basically half the city off.
Yeah,
To get it down, because I remember some reporters had gone over, I was listening, I believe, to an NPR report, some reporters that had gone over ahead of time to kind of watch the transition, and she was talking about, like, pulling soot out of her hair like snowflakes.
Yeah. Yeah, oh,
like,
no.
That it was that heavy.
China, the burden of pollution in China is overwhelming. It's almost inconceivable if you haven't to read about it doesn't even convey it fully. You know, if you haven't seen it, it's almost hard to believe how polluted China's becoming and how quickly they're progressing, like I said, at a blistering pace with no regard for environmental safety.
Yeah, well, I think the main point from that to take is that the numbers, the actual number one spot shifts around a little bit, and I'm not sure where it lies today. But the China is, as far as an indicator of their growth, are both among the world's burners of coal and installers of solar energy simultaneously.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, the China has invested heavily in alternative energy. It's just the question of, you know, it's such a huge population and it has such a long way to go towards full industrialization, and it's achieving that goal. It's going to industrialize, you know, 1.3 billion people, and it's largely going to accomplish that through coal, even though it is heavily investing much more in alternative energy than, say, the States is.
All right. Well, I think that's a good place to pause. We're going to go to the story of stuff now with Annie Leonard. If you haven't heard of the story stuff, please do go check it out. Absolutely fantastic animated videos. They are self-sufficient without the video, though, so we're going to listen to the audio today. But they have many, many more videos than we're going to be playing today. Please do go and check it out. We'll have a link on the website afterwards. They're fantastic. So this one is called The Story of Electronics.
This is a story about a world obsessed with stuff. It's a story about a system in crisis. We're trashing the planet, we're trashing each other, and we're not even having fun. The good thing is that when we start to understand the system, we start to see lots of places to step in and turn these problems into solutions. The other day, I couldn't find my computer charger. My computer is my lifeline to my work, my friends, my music. So I looked everywhere, even in that drawer where this lives. I know you have one too, a tangle of old chargers, the sad remains of electronics past. How did I end up with so many of these things? It's not like I'm always after the latest gadget. My old devices broke or became so obsolete I couldn't use them anymore. And not one of these old chargers fits my computer. Ugh! This isn't just bad luck. It's bad design. I call it design for the dump. Design for the dump sounds crazy, right? But when you're trying to sell lots of stuff, it makes perfect sense. It's a key strategy of the companies that make our electronics. In fact, it's a key part of our whole unsustainable materials economy. Design for the dump means making stuff to be thrown away quickly. Today's electronics are hard to upgrade, easy to break, and impractical to repair. My DVD player broke, and I took it to a shop to get fixed. The repair guy wanted $50 just to look at it. A new one at Target cost $39. In the 1960s, Gordon Moore, the giant brain and semiconductor pioneer, predicted that electronics designers could double processor speed every 18 months. So far, he's been right. This is called Moore's Law. But somehow, the bosses of these genius designers got it all twisted up. They seem to think that Moore's Law means every 18 months we have to throw out our old electronics and buy more. Problem is, the 18 months that we use these things are just a blip in their entire life cycle. And that's where these dump designers aren't just causing a pain in our wallets, they're causing a global toxic emergency. You see, electronics start where most stuff starts, in mines and factories. Many of our gadgets are made from 1,000 different materials, shipped from around the world to assembly plants. There, workers turn them into products using loads of toxic chemicals, like PVC, mercury, solvents, and flame retardants. Today, this usually happens in far-off places that are hard to monitor, but it used to happen near my home in Silicon Valley, which, thanks to the electronics industry, is one of the most poisoned communities in the U.S. IBM's own data revealed that its workers making computer chips had 40% more miscarriages and were significantly more likely to die from blood, brain, and kidney cancer. The same thing is starting to happen all around the world. It turns out the high-tech industry isn't as clean as its image. So, after its toxic trip around the globe, it lands in my hands. I love it for a year or so, and then it starts drifting further from its place of honor on my desk or in my pocket. Maybe it spends a little time in my garage before being tossed out. And that brings us to disposal, which we think of as the end of its life. But really, it's just moved on to become part of the mountains of e-waste we make every year. Remember how these devices were packed with toxic chemicals? Well, there's a simple rule of production. Toxics in, toxics out. Computers, cell phones, TVs, all this stuff is just waiting to release all their toxics when we throw them away. Some of them are slowly releasing this stuff even while we're using them. You know those fat old TVs that people are chucking for high-def flat screens? They each have about 5 pounds of lead in them. Lead, as in lead poisoning. So, almost all of this e-waste either goes from my garage to a landfill, or it gets shipped overseas to the garage workshop of some guy in Guiyu, China, whose job it is to recycle it. I've visited a bunch of these so-called recycling operations. Workers without protective gear sit on the ground, smashing open electronics to recover the valuable metals inside and chucking or burning the parts that no one will pay them for. So while I'm on to my next gadget, my last gadget is off poisoning families in Guiyu or India or Nigeria. Each year, we make 25 million tons of e-waste, which gets dumped, burned, or recycled. And most recycling is anything but green. So are the geniuses who design these electronics actually evil geniuses? I don't think so, because the problems they're creating are well hidden even from them. You see, the companies they work for keep these human and environmental costs out of sight and off their accounting books. It's all about externalizing the true costs of production. Instead of companies paying to make their facilities safe, the workers pay with their health. Instead of them paying to redesign using fewer toxics, villagers pay by losing their clean drinking water. Externalizing costs allow companies to keep designing for the dump. They get the profits and everyone else pays. When we go along with it, it's like we're looking at this toxic mess and saying to companies, "You made it, but we'll deal with it." I've got a better idea. How about you made it, you deal with it? Doesn't that make more sense? Imagine that instead of all this toxic e-waste piling up in our garages or in the streets of Guiyu, we sent it to the garages of the CEOs who made it. You can bet that they'd be on the phone to their designers pretty fast demanding they stop designing for the dump. Making companies deal with their e-waste is called extended producer responsibility, or product take-back. If all these old gadgets were their problem, it would be cheaper for them to just design them longer-lasting, less toxic, and more recyclable in the first place. They could even make them modular so that when one part broke, they could just send us a new piece instead of taking back the whole broken mess. Already, take-back laws are popping up all over Europe and Asia. In the U.S., many cities and states are passing similar laws. These laws need to be protected and strengthened. It's time to get these brainiacs on our side. With take-back laws and citizen action to demand greener products, we can start a race to the top, where designers compete to make long-lasting, toxic-free products. So let's have a green Moore's Law. How about the use of toxic chemicals will be cut in half every 18 months? The number of workers poisoned will decline at an even faster rate. We need to give these designers a challenge they can rise to and do what they do best, innovate. Already, some of them are realizing they're too smart to be dump designers and are figuring out how to make computers without PVC or toxic flame retardants. Good job, guys. But we can do even more. When we take our e-waste to recyclers, we can make sure they don't export it to developing countries. And when we do need to buy new gadgets, we can choose greener products. But the truth is, we are never going to just shop our way out of this problem, because the choices available to us at the store are limited by the choices of designers and policymakers outside of the store. That's why we need to join with others to demand stronger laws on toxic chemicals and on banning e-waste exports. There are billions of people out there who want access to the incredible web of information and entertainment that electronics offer. but it's the access they want, not all the toxic garbage. So let's get our brains working on sending that old design for the dump mentality to the dump where it belongs, and instead building an electronics industry and a global society that's designed to last.
All right, that was the story of stuff featuring Annie Leonard. That was the story of electronics. We're going to play one more for you today just to spare my aching voice, but Kevin and I are going to chat for a minute first. Kevin, one of the stories that I saw yesterday was a story about how there was Nevaz.org, I believe, their petition website, generally fairly associated with politics, political issues, policy, this sort of thing. And this one was to send, they wanted 1 million people to sign up to be opposed to a new genetically modified salmon that grows twice as big, twice as fast, doesn't have any breeding cycles around the year. It just grows constantly throughout the year. There's no natural cycle to it. I think the closest thing that I'd be willing to call a Franken food or a Franken fish to date that we've seen. And these are apparently on the verge of being released. However, we're going to leave that aspect of it for now. I think if people are interested, we'll have a link up. You can go and read the article. We don't have quite enough time to get into the details of it. So, right. So if you're interested, please go and check the website. I'll have a link up for it. What I wanted to pose to you instead was the idea that if, you know, we had Paul on at the beginning talking about how, you know, meat in general is unhealthy for the environment. It's a massive consumer of resources, nitrates, water, all sorts of things. So let's get off regular meat. But there was a story a while ago that I saw where people were attempting to use stem cells. In fact, some very promising preliminary studies had been done. They have done some, they've worked out some of the kinks to grow meat in test tubes. So literally what they're doing is they're stimulating stem cells to grow a steak without the rest of the cow. Now, I ask you, I personally am more comfortable with the idea of something that is actually meat. It's not been genetically modified. It was just not grown with the rest of the cow, but it's real meat. I'm personally more comfortable with that than somebody genetically modifying and messing around with something, you know, 3.8 billion years of evolution, and then all of a sudden we're like, no, we're just going to change this. Comment.
Well, speaking as a vegan, I've got no use for meat in any form. But
I mean, we still, you know, there are prominent subject things to consume, like, you know, tofurkey and that sort of thing.
Right.
Clearly, yeah. There's an interest even among vegans or vegetarians to eat meat-like products.
Substances, right. Yeah. Well, I actually don't have really that much objection with it either. If it's not something that can, like, with other genetically modified organisms, or with other sort of genetic manipulation, there's always the reality that it eventually escapes into the surrounding environment, and this isn't something that can do that. It's controlled. It's limited. It
literally only goes where you put it. It has
exactly.
No legs.
It can't lead to genetic pollution in the environment. You know, and it's true that agriculture, livestock agriculture diverts. It's a massive land use issue. It consumes massive amounts of land. You know, we're literally burning rainforest to produce McDonald's hamburgers. And in North America for cattle ranching, we divert unimaginable amounts of water to maintaining livestock. You know, there's so many rivers in the States that no longer reach the sea. And one of the main sources of diversion is cattle ranching. Among others, and so, you know, if this reduced the burden of human activity on the planet, and it was not something that could itself contaminate the environment, then I actually don't have a problem with it. You wouldn't catch me eating it, mind you. but if it could solve land use, water use issues without introducing genetic pollution into the existing environment, I've got no qualms with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of my position on it too. I totally understand people's knee-jerk reaction to it. It does seem very unnatural, but I would put forth that it is more natural than stuff like this Frankenfish. If we have to compare apples to apples, it's closer to being natural.
Oh, it's,
getting it by a very unnatural process, but the product itself would be natural. It's coming directly from stem cells.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I agree. It's less of a Frankenfood than GMOs, which where the jury is still completely out, and we might not know the full effect of genetic manipulation for decades to come. You know, when you're talking about, and especially as I've said before on this show, the genetic modification that occurs with trans species manipulation where we take a gene from, you know, a fish and put it in wheat. We don't know the behavior of that gene. We can't fully predict the behavior of any gene absent the environment that expresses it. And we're talking about moving it not only to a new environment, but to an entirely new organism in a new environment. And we're going to say we can predict the way that gene will express itself and the effects that it's going to have on the organism, on the environment, on human health. It's just, it's such a reckless game we're playing with genetic modification that, you know.
Whenever I think of that, I think of Jurassic Park. There really is no other. Yeah. We got it under control. Electric fences. We got it on lockdown. Yeah. No problem. We're going to have to move on because we're almost out of time, but I will have links to that story if anyone wants to check it out. And I'm going to do my absolute best to find the one that I found with the pictures about the test tube meat. I can't make any promises, but I'm going to do my best. And if I don't find it immediately and somebody really, really is interested, email me and I'll exert more effort trying to track it down. For now, we're going to go to our second story of stuff for the day. This is the story of bottled water, back with Annie Leonard from the Story of Stuff Project.
This is a story about a world obsessed with stuff. It's a story about a system in crisis. We're trashing the planet, we're trashing each other, and we're not even having fun. The good thing is that when we start to understand the system, we start to see lots of places to step in and turn these problems into solutions. One of the problems with trying to use less stuff is that sometimes we feel like we really need it. What if you live in a city like, say, Cleveland, and you want a glass of water? Are you going to take your chances and get it from the city tap? Or should you reach for a bottle of water that comes from the pristine rainforest of Fiji? Well, Fiji brand water thought the answer to this question was obvious, so they built a whole ad campaign around it. It turned out to be one of the dumbest moves in advertising history. You see, the city of Cleveland didn't like being the butt of Fiji's jokes, so they did some tests, and guess what? These tests showed a glass of Fiji water is lower quality, it loses taste tests against Cleveland tap, and costs thousands of times more. This story is typical of what happens when you test bottled water against tap water. Is it cleaner? Sometimes, sometimes not. In many ways, bottled water is less regulated than tap. Is it tastier? In taste tests across the country, people consistently choose tap over bottled water. These bottled water companies say they're just meeting consumer demand. But who would demand a less sustainable, less tasty, way more expensive product, especially when you can get for almost free in your kitchen? Bottled water costs about 2,000 times more than tap water. Can you imagine paying 2,000 times the price of anything else? How about a $10,000 sandwich? Yet people in the U.S. buy more than 500 million bottles of water every week. That is enough to circle the globe more than 5 times. How did this come to be? Well, it all goes back to how our materials economy works, and one of its key drivers, which is known as manufactured demand. If companies want to keep growing, they have to keep selling more and more stuff. In the 1970s, giant soft drink companies got worried as they saw their growth projections starting to level off. There's only so much soda a person can drink. Plus, it wouldn't be long before people began realizing soda is not that healthy and turned back to, gasp, drinking tap water. Well, the companies found their next big idea in a silly designer product that most people laughed off as a passing yuppie fad. Water is free, people said back then. What will they sell us next? Air? So how do you get people to buy this fringe product? Simple. You manufacture demand. How do you do that? Well, imagine you're in charge of a bottled water company. Since people aren't lining up to trade their hard-earned money for your unnecessary product, you make them feel scared and insecure if they don't have it. And that's exactly what the bottled water industry did. One of their first marketing tactics was to scare people about tap water with ads like Fiji's Cleveland campaign. When we're done, one top water executive said, tap water will be relegated to showers and washing dishes. Next, you hide the reality of your product behind images of pure fantasy. Have you ever noticed how bottled water tries to seduce us with pictures of mountain streams and pristine nature? But guess where a third of all bottled water in the U.S. actually comes from? The tap. Pepsi's Aquafina and Coke's Dasani are two of the many brands that are really filtered tap water. But the pristine nature lie goes much deeper. In a recent full-page ad, Nestle said, bottled water is the most environmentally responsible consumer product in the world. What? They are trashing the environment all along the product's life cycle. Exactly how is that environmentally responsible? The problems start here with extraction and production, where oil is used to make water bottles. Each year, making the plastic water bottles used in the U.S. takes enough oil and energy to fuel 1 million cars. All that energy spent to make the bottle, even more to ship it around the planet, and then we drink it in about 2 minutes? That brings us to the big problem at the other end of the life cycle, disposal. What happens to all these bottles when we're done? 80% end up in landfills, where they will sit for thousands of years, or in incinerators, where they are burned, releasing toxic pollution. The rest gets collected for recycling. I was curious about where the plastic bottles that I put in the recycling bins go. I found out that shiploads were being sent to India, so I went there. I will never forget riding over a hill outside Madras, where I came face to face with a mountain of plastic bottles from California. Now, real recycling would turn these bottles back into bottles. But that wasn't what was happening here. Instead, these bottles were slated to be downcycled, which means turning them into lower quality products that would just be chucked later. The parts that couldn't be downcycled were thrown away there, shipped all the way to India just to be dumped in someone else's backyard. If bottled water companies want to use mountains on their labels, it would be more accurate to show one of these mountains of plastic waste. Scaring us, seducing us, and misleading us. These strategies are all core parts of manufacturing demand. Once they've manufactured all this demand, creating a new multi-billion dollar market, they defend it by beating out the competition. But in this case, the competition is our basic human right to clean, safe drinking water. Pepsi's vice chairman publicly said, "The biggest enemy is tap water. They want us to think it's dirty and bottled water is the best alternative." In many places, public water is polluted, thanks to polluting industries like the plastic bottle industry. And these bottled water guys are all too happy to offer their expensive solutions, which keep us hooked on their products. It is time we took back the tap. That starts with making a personal commitment to not buy or drink bottled water unless the water in your community is truly unhealthy. Yes, it takes a bit of foresight to grab a reusable bottle on the way out, but I think we can handle it. Then, take the next step. Join a campaign that's working for real solutions, like demanding investment in clean tap water for all. In the U.S., tap water is underfunded by $24 billion, partly because people believe drinking water only comes from a bottle. Around the world, 1 billion people don't have access to clean water right now. Yet cities all over are spending millions of dollars to deal with all the plastic bottles we throw out. What if that money was spent improving our water systems, or better yet, preventing pollution to begin with? There are many more things we can do to solve this problem. Lobby your city officials to bring back drinking fountains. Work to ban the purchase of bottled water by your school, your organization, or entire city. This is a huge opportunity for millions of people to wake up and protect our wallets, our health, and the planet. The good news is it's already started. Bottled water sales have begun to drop while business is booming for safe, refillable water bottles. Yay! Restaurants are proudly serving tap, and people are choosing to pocket the hundreds or thousands of dollars they would otherwise be wasting on bottled water. Carrying bottled water is on its way to being as cool as smoking while pregnant. We know better now. The bottled water industry is getting worried because the jig is up. We are not buying into their manufactured demand anymore. We will choose our own demands, thank you very much, and we are demanding clean, safe water for all.
And we are back. That is it. That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank very much our first guest, which was Paul Figueres from the Vegan Environmental Party of Ontario. I want to also thank Kevin very much for coming in and helping my spare my voice.
Thanks, Darren.
Had some good fun as usual. Laughs and fun had by all. Good times. That's all the time we have for The Green Majority, though. Please check out greenmajority.ca. You can email us at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. And any other information you might need to contact us, give us thumbs up, thumbs down, sideways thumbs, whatever you want. We just love hearing from people, so go ahead and give us a call. Other than that, we want to wish very good luck to the following show, and we'll talk to you guys next week.